Hello and welcome to the podcast of Vineyard Church here in Maryville, Tennessee. We post our Sunday messages here each week, as well as our conversations episodes, which include interviews, special announcements, and in-depth teaching. You can visit vineyardchurch.us to learn more about us or to access the audio archive. You can also subscribe to this podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google Podcasts. And now, here's the episode.
Well, hey everyone, good morning. If you're new, welcome, and shout out to those of you joining us online, and happy 4th of July week. I know it's not always easy to be here, especially on a busy week, so thank you for being here. Today, as you can probably tell, it's going to be a little bit different. I want to explore a story that is familiar, but from a slightly different angle. We're going to be spending a good bit of time today in Genesis 3, but before we get there, just a couple of things from pages 1 and 2 of your Bibles that I want to talk about. So if you were to just take your Bible, open it up to the first page, and just start reading, what you're going to find is that you encounter a story that has three images. It's dark, it's like a desert, it's like you're in the middle of the chaotic ocean. And each of those images is picked up in various ways as God creates this beautiful world full of life. But there's two features of this story that I really want to draw your attention to. Okay, so on the screen up here, on the left is day one, and on the right is day four. And in the kind of lighter purple color, there's this language of God saw the light as good. And there's a parallel in day four of God saw that it was good. And as you read the story, what you're going to find is seven times God sees as good. He will see the trees as good. He's going to see the dry land as good. It's all very good. But there are a couple of things that, interestingly, maybe are not good. So, for example, God says on the left here, God saw the light as good, but what about the darkness? And on day two, when God makes the blue skies and the blue seas, nothing on day two is called good. And so then that begs this question, well, what makes something good? Why is the dry land good? Why is the sky not good? And so it seems like whatever definition we use, it is really closely connected with this idea of life and flourishing, and in particular, human life and flourishing. So if you haven't noticed, like humans don't do particularly well when left in the middle of the ocean or in the middle of the sky or in a deep, dark, black pit, right? So when we read that God saw that it was good, this seeing as good is an evaluation of a question of whether something is going to be life-sustaining and life-giving. So that's number one, okay? So point number one, pretty simple. This language of seeing as good means that that thing is life-giving. You look at it and you say, yep, that will give and sustain life. Second thing I want to point out, notice again at the very top, notice the kind of mustardy yellow color. Both of these days start off with this language of like, let there be light. So on day one, let there be light. On day four, the parallel, let there be light. On day one, God separates light from darkness, day from night. But on day four, who does the separating? The lights do, the hosts of heaven. So when what God does on day one, he delegates on day four. He shares power. And in the story, God shares power with two groups of rulers. The way the story is designed, day one and four are parallel, but then days four and six are also parallel. And they end up contrasting these two groups of rulers. So on day four, you have those rulers of the skies, the hosts of heaven. They have lots of different names in the Bible. Angels, cherubs, the sons of God, the watchers, all kinds of different names. And on day six, you have the rulers or hosts of the dry land, the humans. And notice the ordering. The firstborn are the rulers of the skies. The secondborn are the humans. But who does God choose to make in his image, if you know the story? The humans, the secondborn. And that's very strange, especially in the ancient world. So on page one of your Bible, what we're introduced to is this creator of all things who apparently doesn't think about power the way that we do. He shares power. He delegates power. He elevates the weak, the last, the younger to rule. And this story is about a lot of different things, but one of them is power and the way that power works or ought to work within the world that God made. It's upside down from the very beginning. And this theme is one that permeates every story in this book hereafter. So there's this whole theme of the firstborn. Every generation in the story sets up two figures. And God constantly chooses to elevate and give life to the weak, the second, the last, those you least expect in the story. But that doesn't have to always exclude the firstborn either. Abraham, he's a firstborn. Joseph, he's a firstborn. And God even says to Cain that if you do good, that's seeing as good language, then you too will be lifted up. So God is generous enough to actually elevate both groups. But it does mean that if you are first, you are going to have to make yourself last and lift up those weaker than you by joining them where they are, down in the dust. And so there's these two features of Genesis 1, okay? This language of God saw it as good, this seeing as good, seeing something that in your eyes will give and create and sustain life, and this kind of upside down view of power with the first and the second born. And that's just page one. You flip the page, and on page two, we pick up the desert image from Genesis 1. It's so dry that there's not even bushes. It's just dust. But God makes this water appear in the desert and shapes these humans, gives them life, and then plants or rests them on top of this garden mountain called Eden. And that's where we'll jump into a little bit of the text here. So we're told something that is really, really, really important at the very top of this mountain in Eden, right in the middle. There is this tree that is pure life, the tree of life, and it's in the middle, okay? In the middle. Just want to keep emphasizing that. Tree of life in the middle of the garden, okay? You keep reading, and what God says is that he says to these humans that everything is yours. Eat generously from every tree in the garden, including presumably the tree of life. But like there's this one thing that will kill you. Don't eat it. And the other tree, that tree of knowing good and evil, it's kind of a bit mysterious, really. It never shows up again anywhere else in the entire story ever. And something really interesting begins to happen with it in the very next chapter in Genesis 3. So at the beginning of Genesis 3 here, we're told that humans are naked, which doesn't just mean they're in their birthday suits, right? It means that they are vulnerable, that they are, but they're not ashamed. Now, shame within this context is about a lot more than embarrassment, okay? It's a status word within an honor and shame culture. They aren't worried about being vulnerable and exploited because they trust the other person. They are two that are one, and they are living in unity, not uniformity because they are different, but unity. And when humans live like that, when marriages live like that, when siblings live like that, Psalm 133 will tell you it's life forever. But things don't stay that long, don't stay that way for very long. In chapter 3, verse 1 here, we are introduced to a firstborn, the snake. Because remember, humans are not the only thing made on day 6. The animals were, and they were first. And the snake then tries to convince God tries to convince Eve that God is holding out on her. You can't trust him. And the whole chapter becomes framed around this question of whose voice are you going to listen to? And so the snake, as within this conversation, the snake says that you're not going to die. God is holding out on you. But Eve, she repeats the lines from earlier, and in particular here, pay attention to what she says. She says, from the fruit of the trees of the garden, we may eat, which is what God said. But from the fruit of the tree, which is in the middle of the garden, we cannot eat. Do you guys remember which one was in the middle? Yeah. And so something really interesting is beginning to happen with these trees. Are they two trees? Are they one tree? You kind of have to keep reading. And so when we get to verse 6 here, the woman, she saw the tree as good. You remember that from chapter 1? God saw things were good 7 times over. She sees as good this tree for eating. She's doing what God did, and that it's desirable for her eyes. But in this case, she's calling something good that God said would kill her. So it's this redefinition of good and evil. And what she's after is this wisdom. She sees it's good to make her wise. Now, what this wisdom is, you kind of have to keep reading the story to sort of get it, but it's pictured actually in Proverbs, as Proverbs kind of replays the story, and you get two women, Lady Wisdom and Lady Folly, in Proverbs 8. And they are kind of images of Eve. And at the end of Proverbs 8, Lady Wisdom says, all those who find me, i.e. wisdom, find life. So this clutching after wisdom is this grasping after life. Okay, so Eve, she's trying to grab life on her own terms, to define good and evil on her own terms. And the whole thing is ironic on so many levels, because do you know what Eve's name means? Living one. She already has the thing that she wants. She can produce life. She's about to be called the mother of all the living. But instead of waiting for God to give her more of the thing he already has, she takes it. She gives it to her husband, and he takes it. One is deceived, one rebels. But after the human and the living one, Adam and Eve, have tried to take life on their own terms and done what's good in their eyes, God enters the scene. So we have this language, and they heard the voice of Yahweh God walking in the garden in the wind of the day. And this is what scholars call theophany language. So it's the language that always comes whenever God shows up, whether you're on Mount Sinai or at the tabernacle or at the temple or the burning bush. It's always this kind of language. And there's actually a really fascinating translation decision here about who is in the tree. So how does the preposition work in Hebrew? Is it that the humans are hiding in the tree, among the trees, or is it the face of Yahweh that is in the tree? If it's the face of Yahweh that's in the tree, then suddenly the burning bush takes on a whole other level of meaning here. But then the scene itself becomes pretty provocative, because Yahweh, the source of all life, he is in the tree that they just ate from. In other words, it becomes an image of trying to take God's own life from him because of what you see as good in your own eyes, in an effort to preserve your own life at the expense of another. And before you say that's crazy, just think about how the gospel writers portray what humans do to Jesus as he is hanging on his tree. Even in Acts, Peter says, you killed the author of life. So humans, they're taking life now, and this sets up the Cain and Abel story and Lamech, who takes two wives for himself after this, and the flood of violence that follows. And so humans, they suddenly realize now in this kind of world that they are naked. They can no longer trust each other. Now they're going to have to worry about each other taking each other's lives. And so what will this world be like now? Well, humans will use their power to try and bring about their own desires and to preserve their own life, and they will rule over each other instead of being one. And we all know how that's going to end up, right? Death and ruin. And that's what God says is going to happen, beginning with the snake. So in Genesis 3:14, God says, you are done for. You tried to make yourself first, but now you're going to be down in the dust, this area of low status and death. That's where you're going to end up. Your seed, your life, your future life, it's done for. And this striking that you did, and you're going to continue to do throughout the rest of the story, this conflict that you've created, that will be your own downfall. Your own evil will come back on your own head. Now, typically, when we start thinking about this story, we are kind of pre-programmed to think of it as something that is exclusively in the past, right? Creation, fall, redemption. Anybody heard that? Yeah. And so, yes, it's true, our ancestors did this, but it also may blind us to the way that this story functions in all the other stories in the rest of the story. This is the beginning, okay? And so it turns out that this story is going to be everywhere in the Bible, this language of seeing as good and grasping after something, seeing something that's desirable, being going after wisdom, trying to redefine good and evil, this theme of the firstborn and the second, this conflict between seeds, these competing voices, this curse language, it all shows up again and again. And part of that vocabulary is that it fits within a story that has certain characters, okay? And so we just met them, Adam, Eve, the snake, the tree. And what we're going to find is that the biblical writers, as they continue telling the rest of the story, they're going to put characters into these slots. And a whole new range of meaning will come out of that. So check this out. We're going to fast forward 9 chapters to meet Abraham in Genesis 12. And Abraham, he starts out as, and he's going to end as, the seed of the woman. But for most of the story, he's acting like a snake. Abraham is. So in Genesis 12 here, there's a problem that's introduced. There's a famine in the land. And Abraham, it's Avram, he went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. So there's no food, there's no probably water, there's no life. And it came about that when he came near to entering Egypt, and he said to Sarah, his wife, "See now, I know that you are beautiful. You are a woman beautiful of sight. You're good to look at," right? "And when the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me, but they're going to let you live. So please say that you are my sister, that there will be good on account of me, that I may live on account of you." So everything here is about life, just like in the Genesis 3 story. This is about Abraham trying to preserve his own life. And here's then what happens. He concocts this scheme to deceive Pharaoh. And so it came about that when Abraham came into Egypt and the Egyptians saw the woman was very beautiful and Pharaoh's officials saw her and praised her before Pharaoh, and the woman was taken, she took, into Pharaoh's house. And he did good to Abraham on account of her. And there was for him sheep and oxen and donkeys and male and female servants, female donkeys and camels. So this is a replay of the Genesis 3 story. So in this story, who is the tree that is beautiful and good and desirable to look at? Sarah. Sarah is the tree. And what's interesting is she ends up being the source of life for Abraham's seed. She is the thing that is forbidden. Why? Not because she's bad, but because her life, while good, doesn't belong to Pharaoh. And then who is the Eve who comes and grabs that tree? It's Pharaoh's officials. And then who they give it to? Pharaoh. Okay? He's the Adam in the figure. So the tree is Sarah. Eve is Pharaoh's officials. Adam is Pharaoh. And then who's the snake? Abraham. Abraham's the snake. He's doing all this deceiving. And then what happens? He gets loaded. He gets all this stuff. But this stuff is going to cause a bunch of problems with Lot in the next chapter. But then notice one of the things he got, female servants, female slaves. You fast forward 4 chapters, we're going to meet one of those female slaves. And her name in Genesis 16 is Hagar. Now, Sarah, the wife of Abraham, had not given birth for him, no life. But she had a slave girl, an Egyptian one, you know, the one that he got when he was deceiving Pharaoh, that one. And her name was Hagar. And Sarah said to Abraham, "Look, please, Yahweh has restrained me from giving birth. Please, go into my slave girl. Perhaps I can be built up by means of her." That whole build up is a little wordplay with what happens in the Adam and Eve story when God makes Eve. And Sarah, the wife of Abraham, took Hagar, the Egyptian slave girl, at the end of 20 years of Abraham dwelling in the land, and she gave to Abraham, her husband, as a wife. And he went into Hagar, and she became pregnant, and she saw that she was pregnant, and her mistress became a curse in her eyes. And Sarah said to Abraham, may the violence done to me be upon you. I gave you my slave girl into your lap, and she saw that she had become pregnant, and I became a curse in her eyes. May Yahweh bring justice because between me and you. And Abraham said to Sarah, look, your slave girl, she's in your hand. Do to her what is good in your eyes. And Sarah oppressed her and sent her out. Who's the tree in this story? The one that is forbidden, that you shouldn't take? It's Hagar. Hagar is the tree in this story. And who is Eve? Sarah. She takes Hagar, she gives her to Abraham, who is the Adam in the story. And the snake, if we go back just one slide. And the snake, who's the snake? No snake. And here's the interesting thing. You don't see him, but you hear his voice. Do you remember what he said in the Eden story? God is holding out on you. Did Yahweh really say that? And what does he say here? Yahweh has restrained me from giving life. That is the voice of the snake in the story. And if you're not paying attention to these design patterns, this is one of those things that can really mess up your whole theology, because you can build an entire view of God as this God who is withholding and restraining life from you. But that's actually the voice of the snake. And the next generation faces this same test. How you guys doing? We're halfway there. Good? Okay. Jacob and Israel, okay? Jacob is Israel, like pretty important guy in the whole story, right? But, and here's the thing with Jacob. He's actually a second born. He's the younger. You expect him, like, this is the good guy. But he comes out grabbing the heel of his brother, just like that snake biting the heel in Genesis 3. And then he proceeds to deceive Esau and take his birthright, his status and power. And then, that wasn't enough, he goes after his blessing. And that's where we're going to park at for a second in Genesis 27. Now, we have zero time to go through the details here, but it's all of the same vocabulary. But there's one little wrinkle in the story that really makes you think back to Genesis 3 and what's going on. In this iteration of this pattern, Jacob and Rachel are the snakes in the story, and they're trying to take Esau's birthright, and they're trying to deceive Isaac. And the whole thing is this massive plan that involves Jacob dressing up like an animal. You remember in the garden story, there was an animal, wasn't there? That snake. And this pattern makes you go back and read the Genesis 3 story and say, okay, who's in the snake suit? Yeah? Okay? And so each generation, every character, they're going to get their moment at the tree in the story, and they have a choice to make, and not everyone is going to take. So for example, if you know the Joseph and the Potiphar, the story of Joseph and Potiphar's wife, Joseph resists. Joseph does not take. All the same language is used in that story. He ends up naked at the end of the story as he runs off. But he doesn't take. And guess what? What happens to him? He ends up in prison down in the pit. And you're like, what the heck? But there's a twist there that is going to matter for the story. And that surprise is actually part of it. But more often than not, we as humans will take. We love to take, even when we don't fully realize it. And so at the beginning of the Exodus, Pharaoh, he's trying to preserve his life and power of his nation and people. And there are these Israelites who are mirrors of Hagar, and they are a threat to his power and the future of his nation. And they are vulnerable, but they're growing strong. And so it is good in Pharaoh's eyes to take the life of all those sons, which one's the firstborn, their future, their life. So Pharaoh replays the same story too. And this is what kings do in the Bible time and time again. They are portrayed as repeating the folly of Pharaoh. So this is actually Samuel's concern. If you flip like halfway through the Old Testament up to 1 Samuel 8, Israel, they want a king like the nations, right? Just like Pharaoh. And Samuel, he is ticked. He's like, nope, not going to happen. God says, give them the thing they want, but warn them. And Samuel has this whole long speech then. He goes, you know what a king is going to do? Let me tell you what a king is going to do. The king is going to take all your women. He's going to take all your horses and chariots. He's going to take. Seven times he's going to take. That's what a king is going to do, like the nations. And that's exactly what happens. 2 Samuel 11, David, he sees Bathsheba. He desires her, and he takes her. And then guess what? He pulls the Cain and Abel card and kills her husband. And from there, it's just a flood of violence. You guys probably know the mantra, right? Saul has killed his thousands, and David his 10,000s, yes. And this is why David can't build the temple. He spilled blood. He took too much life. And everything is essentially downhill until this one moment, this flicker of hope with Solomon. And Solomon, he says this thing that like should make us just start cheering. Like if you're reading the story, it's just failure, 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 and then it's just like, yes, this is what we have been waiting for. Lord, my God, you have now made your servant king in my father David's place. Yet I am just a youth with no knowledge. Your servant is among your people. You have chosen a people too many to be counted, just like Genesis 1. And so give your servant a heart that will hear to judge your people and to discern, like that tree, between good and evil. For who is able to judge this people, this great people of yours? And it pleased the Lord that Solomon had requested this. So God said to him, because you have requested this, and you did not ask for long life or riches for yourself, the death of your enemies, but you have discernment for yourself to administer justice, I will therefore do what you have asked. I will give you a wise and understanding heart. Do you remember what Eve was after, right? Wisdom. So that there has never been anyone like you before and never will be again. In addition, I will give you what you did not ask for, both riches and honor, so that no king will be your equal during your entire life. If you walk in my ways and keep my statutes and commands, that tree of life, it's yours. I will give you long life. But Solomon, he ends up taking all these women and taking all these chariots and horses for war, as an effort to sustain his own life, because he, at the end of the story, he doesn't trust God to keep giving him life. He has to secure it through his own military prowess, and it brings curse and ruin on the whole story. So under Solomon's kingdom, Israel and Judah, they're one. The two are one, yeah? Just like Adam and Eve, the northern and the southern kingdoms, they're united. But after Solomon, they can't trust each other anymore. There's civil war, and they split. Israel becomes the name of the 10 northern tribes. Judah, the name of the two and a half southern tribes. And then just like Adam and Eve are exiled into the garden, or exiled from the garden, I should say, Israel and Judah are eventually exiled from the land. Assyria comes and mixes up Israel's seed amongst the nations, and then Babylon comes and drags Judah into slavery, just like that snake. And even when Cyrus the Persian allows the southern tribes to go back, it's still a total failure. Ezra and Nehemiah is a failure story. Most Jews don't return, and Israel, the 10 northern tribes, they never come back. There's no king, and everybody does what's right in their own eyes. Yeah? But there is hope that someone will come who will lead the way back into the land and also the way back up the mountain garden to the tree of life. And here we come to the story of Jesus. In Matthew's version of the gospel here, we get a kind of replay of Genesis 1 and 2 and the Exodus. And just like the Exodus, Jesus comes up out of the water of his baptism, and then he goes off into the wilderness, snake country. And there, where Adam and Eve were enslaved, he faces the snake. And in that last test number 3, says the devil took him up on this very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the earth, just like Eden, an Eden-like mountain. And he said to him, I will give you all these things if you will fall down and worship me. And then Jesus told him, go away, Satan, for it's written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only. So Jesus is taken up on this mountain, and he faces the same choice as Adam and Eve, one about power and life. And the snake offers him all the kingdoms of the earth, all power, all rule, all authority, the rule over all life. and Jesus has the opportunity to take it. And so is he going to wait for his father to give him the thing that he promised him? Or is he going to take it on his own terms and join the snake and rule in the way the snake does? And Jesus chooses life. He chooses God's way of life and his way of ruling. And what does that look like? Well, Jesus tells you, because right after this, he goes up onto a mountain and he tells you how the kingdom of God works in this Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the poor. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. It's this entire upside-down way of power, the complete opposite of what the snake offers. And so, and one of the other gospels then tells us that the snake left him until a more opportune time, which the snake found when Jesus was alone in a garden up on a mountain the night before his crucifixion. And he has a choice. Will he attempt to preserve his own life, or will Jesus trust God's wisdom and power to sustain his life? And Jesus is pleading with God to preserve his life, but he's willing to give it up. And he trusts God to give him life and power in the kingdom he promised him, even if that means walking through death and coming out the other side. And that's exactly what happens. Jesus walks through death and out the other side, giving him resurrection life and that tree of life. And in his resurrection and enthroned body, he tells his disciples in Matthew 28, all authority in heaven on earth has been given to me. So the very thing that was humanity is that the serpent took and that the serpent then offered Jesus is the thing that he ends up with at the end of the story. But he didn't take it, meaning he didn't use snake power to get it, violence and deception. He waited for God to give it to him via this upside-down view of power that, as Paul put it, enables him to subject everything to himself. And this then ends up being the absolutely insane twist in the story. Because you know, after all the patterns and all the twists and turns, you know what ends up being the tree of life? The cross. And this whole thing becomes a question then of what you see. How do you think about power? How do you discern good and evil? Not in terms of like what's right and wrong, but in this way. When the Pharisees and the Sadducees and Herod and Pilate saw Jesus, when they looked at this cross, they saw someone who was deceiving the nation, who was going to get everyone killed, someone whose wisdom was foolishness. I mean, how could you possibly defeat Rome by going 2 miles with one of their soldiers instead of one? By blessing your enemies and praying for those who curse you. That's not how the world works. And so what this cross looks like is death and foolishness and a failure. I mean, they killed him, like he lost, right? But the people who wrote the Gospels and who swore allegiance to Jesus rather than Caesar, they saw something else in this tree. They saw life, resurrection life, the tree of life, the presence of God. And they saw a different way of being human and thinking about life and power. And so every generation, each person, they get their moment at this tree in front of it to enter into and to become a part of this story. And this seems to be what Paul frames, this seems to be how Paul frames things in Romans 16. So in Romans 16, at the beginning, or at the end of the letter, he's greeting all these different co-workers and believers who are part of the church at Rome. And then he says the thing that we read. And he was targeting these people who are causing division, who want to take the unified body and turn it into more than one. And they're creating all these obstacles, but he wants them to watch out for these people who want to satisfy their own appetites, food, like tree kind of stuff. And these people who are deceiving people and who have this smooth talk and flattering words, snake language, yeah? And Paul says, though, that the report of your obedience has reached everybody, and I'm going to rejoice over you, but I want you to be wise about what is good and innocent about what is evil. He's replaying the whole Genesis 3 story throughout this whole thing. And then here's the punchline. The God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet. Whose feet? y'alls. Yeah. And so Paul here, he's alluding to that line from Genesis 3 in verses 14 and 15 about this kind of head crushing. But when he does so, he's reminding us of something really important, that God is the God of peace and life. And as you think about the story, there's a reason why Jesus washed Judas's feet the night he betrayed him. There's a reason why Jesus healed the ear that Peter cut off of the men who came to arrest him. There's a reason why Jesus asked for the forgiveness of those who killed him. There's a reason why Jesus said to love our enemies. And Paul said just four chapters earlier in Romans, at the end of chapter 12, don't be conquered by evil, but conquer evil with good. And so the way that we think about power and how we define good and evil and what we call and see as good in order to preserve our life and to make ourselves first, it has this really significant impact on how and when God is able to make all things right. And God intends to cause all things to work together for good through us. God wants to use us. We are his body, right? Have you ever wondered where Paul got that idea, that we are his body? You know, in Genesis 2, in that story with Adam and Eve, there's something really interesting about Eve. She comes from his own body. And she's also his bride. And all the images of the body of Christ and the bride of Christ come from this story. And so you can almost hear Paul popping up in here like he does in Ephesians and says, this is a great mystery, but really we're talking about Christ and the church, the Messiah and his people. And so when you think about the characters in this story, we are all players in this story, but not merely as part of the fail story, but as part of the victory story. And through Jesus, we are invited to eat from the tree of life, the cross. And if we continue to ingest his life, it has the power to change us and to give us resurrection life. And so as the story continues, we can at times actually be put into the slot of the tree of life. Check out what Proverbs does here. The fruit of the righteous is a tree of life, but a cunning person takes lives. And so this raises a really important point about the way that we think about phrases like bearing fruit or being fruitful or having the fruit of the Spirit that we kind of throw around here all the time. You have this tree that is covered in fruit. And the point is not to say, well, that's a nice tree. The point is that the fruit functions for others to consume. You are offering your life. You are giving it to others. And don't forget that if you're a plant, like your fruit is your future. You're giving up your life. And people who wield the power of the snake, who are cunning and crafty, they're going to take life. And so the question then is one entirely around trust. Do you trust that God has the power to give you life even if others take it? Or do desperate times call for desperate measures? The army is coming, the clock is ticking, and if it takes 33 years like it took for Sarah, that's just too long. And this works on so many levels. So part of the reason why I had so many different examples from Abraham to Jacob to Pharaoh to David to the kings is because this question sits at like the very center of our lives as individuals, but also all the way up to nations. So as individuals, like Abraham taking Hagar, but all the way up to nations, like Pharaoh seeking to preserve his nation and entrusting that his nation was first at the expense of Israel's firstborn. And so as we reflect on this whole story and we move into our time of Selah, this is not just something that our ancestors faced and messed up. We all get our moment at this tree. We all have the same choice they did. And so what are we going to choose? What are you going to choose? What is good in your eyes that you either are thinking about taking, have the opportunity to take, or have taken? And taking, if there's one lesson here, it's that taking, it has real consequences. It had real consequences for Hagar and Sarah and Bathsheba and Israel and humanity. It really matters. But taking isn't the end of the story. Even though Abraham took, God still was able to bring him up the mountain in Genesis 22. And Jesus has brought us all there now, and he offers us his life. Don't try to take something else that you think will give you the life you want. Jesus freely gives his life to anyone who is willing to give their life in return. And so just allow me to read this final paragraph, and we'll close from there as Chris and others are coming up. True life, the kind that builds and multiplies and sustains, it doesn't come from taking what seems good in our own eyes, but from trusting the God who gives life generously and abundantly. In a world of competing voices and snakes and scarcity, the real question is whether we will use our power to preserve our own lives by taking life that isn't ours, or wait for God to give us more of what he's already given, using the life we have to lift up and preserve those whose lives are failing, the weak, the poor, the vulnerable, the oppressed, rather than securing our own life at their expense. And in that kind of world, humans can trust each other with each other's lives, and the two can become one again.